The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. A guilty verdict that rang through Downing Street. David Cameron's former press secretary, Andy Coulson, is convicted of conspiring to hack phones while editor of the News of the World. Cameron says sorry and is immediately rebuked by a judge. And in a week where nothing's gone right for the Prime Minister, as the EU ignores his protests, it's set about installing Jean-Claude Juncker as Commission President. What will this mean for Britain's relations with Europe? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian's political sage, Michael White, and returning to our fold, our new political correspondent, Raphael Baer. A warm welcome to you both. Now, it was a mixed week for the red tops of Fleet Street. 5 years after The Guardian first reported on phone hacking at the News of the World, its editor, Andy Coulson, was convicted at the Old Bailey. His predecessor and former Sun editor, Rebecca Brooks, however, walked free of all charges. Now, the verdict on Coulson was a body blow for David Cameron, who had ignored repeated warnings not to hire the former editor. Raphael, we've got to be a bit careful on what we say here, as there's related trials going on and some yet to begin. But this was, we know enough to say, don't we, a massive misjudgment on Cameron's part.
Yeah, David Cameron, he has admitted that, you know, if he knew then what he knows now, it would have been different. And therefore, bringing someone who it turns out was a criminal, we can say that quite clearly, into the heart of Downing Street. Well, obviously, he wishes he hadn't done that because it's caused him a lot of embarrassment. I mean, the interesting thing from Cameron's point of view is that I think still, and it was clear from the way he responded to this in Parliament in Prime Minister's questions, he still thinks and he's still very confident that ultimately this is a sort of media sphere, Westminster elite kind of preoccupation that most, as it were, sort of civilian, ordinary voters don't care that much. They were quite upset when the revelations first came out that Millie Dowler's phone had been hacked. That raised real animus and passion among voters. But it, certainly after the Leveson inquiry came out, the view in Downing Street was actually, this was an exoneration of the Prime Minister, that there was no sort of conspiracy between him and Murdoch or Coulson or any of the rest of it. And ultimately, Labour will try and use this as the sort of Cameron view. Labour will try to use this as a stick to beat the Prime Minister, but it's not strong enough and the bruises won't last and he can get away with that. And that was clearly the strategy that he employed in Parliament on Wednesday. And the last thing to say about that is that there is a large section of the press that will sort of support Cameron in taking that view, because obviously there are bits of the media sphere that don't want this to be a big story either.
Vested interest then. Mike, so a misjudgment, Raph saying, but maybe one that in the end our boy might get away with.
Yeah, I think Raphael's broadly right in what he's saying. The voters get indignant over Millie Dowler's phone and the tabloids tell lies about it. And life goes on. I mean, I remember years ago, any questions, Dimbleby asking the audience, will you not buy this paper next week? They all put their hands up. And of course, the following week, any questions sends a researcher down, have sales drawn and fallen in that particular town? No, of course they haven't. They go on buying it. It's what we call humbug. George Orwell wrote about it a long time ago, English Murder and the Sunday Papers. So Cameron's right in that shrewd, slightly cynical judgment. And I'm not sure, really, whether the focus should primarily be on him. Yes, he made a mistake. Yes, it isn't good enough to say he didn't know about Andy Coulson, because a whole queue of people came in to see him and warn him. Even The Guardian, playing pretty straight about that, I thought. Andy Coulson once told me, The Guardian's campaign is all about David Cameron. It's not really about me, Rupert Murdoch. And I said, no, I didn't like that, Andy. It's about the power of Murdoch primarily, and Cameron's just in the middle. But that was a bad call. The Guardian's Ian Katz went in and warned Cameron's aides before he went to number 10, don't do it. But unfortunately, his advice got caught in a firefight, because the man he spoke to wanted Gitto Harry, who later went to work for BBC Man, later went to work for Boris Johnson, to get the job. So, as it were, his warning was probably slightly suspect, and it all went wrong, and Cameron did it anyway. Cocky chap. Matthew Dancona, who wrote All in It Together, the sort of probably the most solid biography of the coalition so far, says Cameron doesn't make many friends. He doesn't let people into his tight little circle. He's a loner, a lot of politicians are. But he let Coulson in. He liked Coulson. He was impressed by him. Loyal to his friends. Working class boy from Essex who knew how to turn dross into tabloid gold.
And it's interesting also, it does appear to be a sort of a habit of David Cameron's character that once he's decided there is an issue that is sort of got up by angry lefties, but that sort of, as it were, real people don't care that much about. He becomes very stubborn about it. And an interesting comparison, I mean, I remember having a conversation, albeit in the presence of Andy Coulson a while ago, with the Prime Minister about this. And his view was very much, you know, we don't get any mail, postbags, complaints about this. It's simply not an issue. Just stop banging on about it. It's not that interesting. And the other issue where I've seen exactly the same response was the question of leaving the European People's Party caucus in the European Parliament and joining up with a bunch of sort of quite fanatical nationalists in the European Parliament. He said, this is just something that you sort of guardianistas are trying to use as a stick to beat me with, and no one else cares. And
that's, well, he's probably right about that, but he and public opinion are both wrong.
Yes, but the point being that once he's sort of driven into that cul-de-sac of this isn't an issue that matters, no one cares, he stops engaging with it intellectually, and then that creates problems for him down the road.
Well, he's a shallow fellow in some ways. He's a clever man, but not a very deep man. In that respect, he's like Tony Blair.
Isn't it rather dangerous for him, though, Mike, just because, you know, there will be ongoing issues about people feeling that there's a corruption of elites in general, and then specifically there could be further trials, investigations, and so on, however they come out, linked to this hacking business.
Well, there will be. I mean, I think the most of it is over, and the Murdoch's family's fortune, I think, did I read in the FT, has gone up from $7 billion since it was forced to reorganise itself to $13 billion. So there's life for you. I don't think Andy Coulson's done as well. I'm troubled that Coulson should be left to carry this can alone. I really am. And with the fellow reporters who went down, I quoted the old music hall song during the week, it's the rich what gets the pleasure, it's the poor what gets the blame. Coulson was a working class boy from Harlow in Essex, and it just doesn't seem right. Never mind, that's what happens. It's not very fair. And Cameron going on there too. I'm astonished too, I might add, and another reason why it works, you said a moment ago, Tom, I think, well, the political class is all regarded as tainted, and I'm afraid that also helps the Cameron narrative. Labour's just as bad as us with Murdoch. Not true, of course, because Ed Miliband dared to stick his head above the parapet before he was photographed with the Sun, the idiot. But that's how voters see it, and this is why the press is able to get away with the extraordinary business of defying Leveson and the Royal Charter, which was meant to put in a statutory basis for reform.
Let's just talk about that.
Wow!
Are they, Mike? I mean, do you think Leveson, is anything going to happen now? First of all, assuming Cameron remains in power for a while, can we just forget the whole of the Leveson settlement?
Well, the press has said no for all sorts of reasons. There were legitimate flaws in Leveson, but the idea that a royal charter was statutory regulation with the politicians putting a chill effect on the press. Try telling Andrew Mitchell that Plebgate was a conspiracy between press and the coppers outside the doors of Downing Street. So don't take too much seriousness of that. No, IPSO, the independent press standards, whatever it is, organisation.
Is that the one set up by the press?
That's the press's version. Mm. Somebody tried to set up a sort of middle way, and I think I forget what it's called. That's got stuck. And the alternative is the charter. And if you trigger the charter mechanisms, that raises the game quite a lot. And the Guardian and the FT and the Independent, and probably the Observer too, stuck in a cleft stick here. What do they do? And nobody's quite sure. But so far, the press is winning. And the way the Sun reacted to Rebecca Brooks getting off a great day for the Red Tops was amazing. You would have thought they'd have had the grace to be a bit coy about it. But no, that's how they see the world. They're like England football managers. They get thrown out of the World Cup in ignominy, and this was almost a triumph. You know, we could have won if it hadn't been for that fella Suarez. Why?
Do you think, Raph, that is this something that Labour and the Liberal Democrats would see as a coalition opportunity, if nothing else, if Leveson's just getting stuck now?
I certainly think that in the event of Ed Miliband forming a government, you can now imagine that one of his first 100 days things that he would aim to do would be address this issue in some way, partly because as Mike said, there was that moment where, you know, the points at which Ed Miliband's sort of leadership ratings have ticked up and people have thought, hang on, here's someone who's got some guts and some fight in him, were in relation to hacking, the sort of standing up to Rupert Murdoch, as they like to put it, and also actually in relation to when the Daily Mail wrote some pretty poisonous things about his dad, and he had a very sort of passionate and instinctive reaction against that. And so there is such a strong feeling in the Labour Party, and now also at the very top of the Labour Party, that it's almost impossible to get a strong sort of social democratic political consensus mobilised in this country because of the power structures that exist in the media. I can imagine that the Miliband government would want to find some way of doing something about this.
And the Lib Dems would be...
Frankly, let's be honest, the Lib Dems, if they want to stay in government, won't have that many red lines in coalition discussions.
Well, up to a point, Lord Copper, as Evelyn Waugh said in his famous parody novel on Fleet Street, still a pretty good read, still tells us what we want to know nearly 100 years on. Up to a point, Lord Copper, because a new Labour government coming in would have to calm down the financial markets, which can do such harm in 5 minutes. I'm not sure that this would dare. The luxury of stuffing the press and picking a new fight with Fleet Street is a Tory Fleet Street at this juncture. They're not going to be in a very strong position.
That's a very good point.
That's not cowardice. It's common sense. You don't storm the barbed wire and the machine guns just to show you're brave.
So it's been a week with perhaps less consequence than we might like to think if our pundits are right here. But David Cameron looked pretty uncomfortable in the middle of it when those verdicts came through. And things in Europe have made the week even worse for him, with Jean-Claude Juncker, who's the placeman of the European People's Party, ready to move into the EU Commission's presidential suite. It would seem that there's little Britain can do to prevent it, despite the Prime Minister's splendidly isolated stand, Raphael. Now, the two sides in this argument both claim to be speaking up for democracy, the European Parliament who wants Mr. Juncker, Mr. Cameron, and lots of people in Westminster who don't. Who's right?
Well, it's terribly complicated because sort of David Cameron does have, in my view, a fairly decent sort of point of principle that he can mobilise in objection to the Juncker nomination. It gets a bit complicated, but essentially, I'll try and distill this. Under the terms of the Lisbon Treaty, the European Commission is obliged, the phrase is, to take account of the results of the European parliamentary elections when choosing a nominee for the Commission presidency.
Go on, pronounce that German word. Go on, do it.
The Spitzenkandidaten.
Well done.
And what has happened is that essentially the European People's Party, which is the sort of the biggest caucus in the European Parliament, had a Spitzenkandidat in the form of a leading candidate in the form of Jean-Claude Juncker. Now, and has said, well, okay, the decision has been made through all sorts of very interesting sort of domestic political convolutions that happened in relation to Angela Merkel's own coalition with Social Democrats in Berlin and other sort of domestic politics in different bits of the European Union. What has happened is they've now decided that ultimately they have to give this job to Mr. Juncker, although actually quite a lot of leaders going to the council with Cameron think he'd be a rubbish candidate and actually don't think he should do it.
And so they think they've genuinely think they've got to do it because that was the biggest party and this was the people's
say. The German left, Martin, whatever he's called, Schulz, who would have been the left's candidate if the left had won the elections in May, he fell in behind Juncker on principle. This is what the Tories call a power grab by the parliament. And if you think of Oliver Cromwell, whose side would he have been on? Parliament versus the kings in Brussels? So it's not devoid of principle on both sides, but Raph is quite right to say an awful lot of horse trading between capitals, the usual stuff, and a lot of these countries want to be nice to Mrs. Merkel, who of course got sandbagged by her own party. She'd have dropped Juncker down well weeks ago, except the SDP in her grand coalition, that's the left, and the German tabloids, they have tabloids too, beat the daylights out of her for going soft on Cameron. They're all trading off, they're sucking up to Merkel, because they want the financial rules on deficits and the banking system to be less onerous And she's the one who can deliver, of course.
But Cameron has two problems here. One is that there's, I mean, I was in a briefing earlier in the week, and the Downing Street seems quite confused about what the exact point of principle they're trying to make is here. Because on the one hand, Mike's absolutely right. They say, look, this is just a power grab by the European Parliament. And actually, it's much more important that the council, the elected heads of government, the bit of the EU that people actually seem to understand makes the decisions.
The bit still that vaguely works.
The bit that vaguely works, still make this decision. But at the same time, they're saying, but if you are going to follow Lisbon and you are going to take account of the results of the European parliamentary elections, one of the results of that was that lots of people voted for Eurosceptic parties and were clearly angry and demanding reform, and Juncker's the worst possible candidate to deliver that. So the Downing Street point seems to be, on the one hand, look, this Lisbon stitch-up is itself bad, but on the other hand, if we follow the Lisbon stitch-up, we should still have a different outcome. And just talking about the one key point to make in all of this is that when Cameron realised that he was going to lose this, he made a tactical decision to go in anyway, fist flailing, all guns blazing, and that was entirely for domestic consumption. He saw that he'd lost it and he thought, well, I might as well torch myself and go martyrdom style for the Eurosceptic cause, because then at least my own party will be cheering back.
He's playing a very dangerous game here, and he did right from the start. Back in 2005, after Michael Howard stepped down, he promised to leave the European People's Party, which is the Euro-Tory party, if you like, and he outbid David Davis, a long-established Eurosceptic, on that point. Davis wouldn't do it because he thought it was irresponsible, and he was right. It wasn't just a question of ending up in the hands of, you know, Eastern European neo-Nazis and all that nonsense. It was about getting out of the loop. Time and time again since then, including a meeting just before this summit in Ypres, Cameron hasn't been among the Euro Tories, and therefore he missed all the gossip and he missed all the trade-offs and all the dealings, and he's been wrong-footed on this one, and it's his own flipping fault.
And it's very interesting in that sense that I've been speaking to very hardline Eurosceptic Tories in Parliament, and they love this outcome. They're cock-a-hoop. They want Juncker as the Commission President.
Of course they do.
And they're very pleased with Cameron. They're cheering him on, not because they support him or they think he's done the right thing. They know he's been completely humiliated and he's got himself into a ridiculous pickle, but they also know that the net outcome of this is they can make the argument the EU is immune from reform. There's no such thing as a proper renegotiation of membership terms. It's really all about in or out, and who are we kidding? The proper conservative argument will be out, and they're ratcheting Cameron into that position. And
the Tory headbangers might be wrong on that point, Tom, because one of the ways the EU works is, you know, will Juncker be unforgiving? Will Germany be unforgiving towards Cameron's intransigence? They know it's all for domestic politics. Or will they say, no, we've got to make it up to the Brits now? And that's often the way Europe works. So we might get a big portfolio, or we might get favours, or Juncker might show, I am the leader of all the Europeans, including the ones who don't like me, and, you know, help Cameron to cut a deal which will save his referendum. Cameron does not want to leave the European Union in 2017, but he's making a very good job of making it easy for those who do.
I mean, are we sure of that, Raph? What, remind us, because, I mean, there had been mixed signals, certainly from the Cabinet, about how people would vote if the promised renegotiation didn't go anywhere. Is Cameron, he hasn't quite said that he'll definitely vote to stay in, has he?
He's left some wriggle room. The sort of the logical conclusion of from the Bloomberg speech, the big speech where Cameron first promised the referendum, is that David Cameron's position is in because he fully expects to get a renegotiation that he imagines will be satisfactory enough that he can present it to the British people in 2017, saying, behold, EU light, this is what we've got, I therefore say in. But he has already been nudged a little bit more into the position that says, well, you know, this would be our aspiration, but we mustn't be afraid. The whole point of the sort of the ultimatum, as it were, to the rest of Europe, we mustn't be afraid to say, if we don't get what we want, then obviously it would be very hard to recommend that. And my sense from speaking to the Eurosceptics, the ferocious Eurosceptics in the Conservative parties, they will be satisfied if by May 2015, that's the general election, Cameron is in a more agnostic position. So he's more explicitly said, look, we'll do what we can, but we're not afraid to leave. Then after that, they will then want to try and nudge him a little bit further. But I think it's very likely now that by May 2015, the position will be, rather than a sort of a default in because we're confident about the negotiation, it will be an agnostic, let's see what we can get, but no one's prejudicing whether we're going to campaign in or out, depends on what happens.
Harold Wilson tried this renegotiation racket when I was a boy in 1975, and he got away with it. It was not a very good renegotiation. Cameron will be hard pressed to pull the trigger off twice. He's in the extraordinary position of being the Alex Salmond of Westminster politics if he's not careful. Salmond wants to, you know, take Scotland off the bus and plucky little Scotland, and he wants to do plucky little Britain. And, you know, if things go really bad in the next couple of years, we could be plucky little Scotland and plucky little England, Wales and Northern Ireland out there in the North Sea, freezing perhaps when they cut the gas off.
That's all we've got time for today. My thanks to Michael White and to Raphael Baer. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.